This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Futuro.
All right, Maria. I know that you and I share a love of old music. So I know that you know this song.
What a difference a day makes.
Maria.
Yes.
Name that tune.
What a difference a day makes.
Good job. That was released by Dinah Washington in 1959.
The thing is that Dinah Washington was somebody that I grew up hearing.
Well, the story is not about Dinah Washington.
Okay.
Did you actually know that that song was written by a Mexican woman composer in 1934? And she was actually huge. Maria Griever wrote upwards of like 800 songs.
And she was in Mexico?
She was Mexican.
Okay.
There's so much more. She wrote for Paramount Pictures, Fox, MGM. She wrote musicals and operas. Like literally she was huge. But have you ever heard her name?
Maria Griever? No. It wasn't never Maria Griever or Maria Griever. No. No idea who she
is.
I mean, I feel like I need to call up mom. Phone a friend.
Not right this second.
Okay. All right. Now, the interesting thing is that the version of the song that I know best is Edie Gourmet singing with Los Panchos.
Cuando vuelva a tu
lado, y esté solo contigo. Las cosas que te digo, no las repitas jamás por compasión. That song was played in my house over and over and over again on Sunday mornings, which is why I know all the lyrics.
Good one. So, Cuando vuelva a tu lado was originally written in 1934, translated into English by Stanley Adams as, dun, 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 what a difference a day makes.
What's funny is that, like, I know that song.
And it's not going to be the last song you recognize. She's like the most famous unknown person you didn't know you knew.
Why don't we know more about her?
That was my question. After researching this story, I realized she was pretty prolific. She remained active until she passed in 1951, and they even made a biopic about her in 1954 with a fairly well-known Mexican-Argentine actress, Libertad Lamarque. So what happened? And so began my quest. I bought a book, which was great. But then when it came to find a voice, nada. The more I started to dig, the more I couldn't believe what I found. Like, the Cliff's Notes version is she was alone in New York City with two kids and had a career starting in the late 20s up until 1951. And this is a time when women didn't do those things.
See, there's this whole element of Mexican women who are, okay, badasses. O sea, mujeres incansables, imparables.
Right? So this is why I knew I had to tell this story, but also where I kept coming to literal dead ends. While I found a bunch of information in the book I bought, I couldn't find much else, but I kept going. My days would consist of finding a name, going back and forth from web to book to public records to obits, and then one day I finally found a name that matched and a confirmed great-grandson. So I wrote him an email.
And so he writes back?
Not right away. So I called him on the phone and I left him a message.
Oh, gosh. So does he call you back?
On a Friday afternoon when I was feeling particularly defeated.
This is Lee Griever, great-grandson of Maria Griever.
Oh, my God. So the great-grandson of Maria Griever. It's amazing.
Yes. OMG. I was starstruck.
I want to know all of the details.
I'm going to tell you everything that I've learned, as well as the roller coaster that it has been to research this story.
Okay, well, let's go. From Futuro Media and PRX, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today we start Genias, a series remembering notable women in music. First up, the prolific composer, Maria Griever.
I obviously wish I could gotten to meet her. She seemed like a total badass. She just seemed like a very strong person. And so I can only imagine the challenges she had along the way.
Okay, Jeannie. So Lee Griever calls you, that is Maria Griever's great grandson, and you're kind of like, oh my God, you're starstruck.
Yep. I honestly thought I would not hear back. But I also knew I would find a way to tell this story. So we'll hear more from the family later on.
Do you have any idea what was her story before you were pitching this story?
I actually did not. Like I said, she was ultra famous. Like Google did a doodle last February. She's Google Doodle famous.
Wow.
It's actually super random how I fell upon Maria Griever, and it was before the doodle. During the pandemic, we're FaceTiming with my family a lot, and my mom starts singing this lullaby to Martin, my son who has this insane ability to pick up music and lyrics, learned the song. And I had to look up the song online so that I could sing the song with my then 2-year-old.
Okay.
And so I'm digging and digging, and I can't find anything. And finally, there it was in all its glory. Te Quiero Dijiste, also known as Muñequita Linda. So I read, and I'm like, music and lyrics by Maria Griever.
Huh.
And I was like, oh, cool, a woman. And then I was like, wait, she's Mexican. Wait, she composed 800 songs in the 1930s. Wait, for Paramount. Wait, she wrote What a Difference a Day Makes. And then, like, literally my mind exploded.
Because, Maria, I am a music engineer. It's hard to be a woman in music today. So I just couldn't get enough.
So take a step back and tell me a moment now. So who was Maria Griever?
Maria Joaquina de la Portilla Torres was born in 1885 in Mexico. Half Mexican and half Spanish, she had dark hair and light skin, more leaning towards her Spanish ancestry and European features. Her records state that she wrote her first song at a very young age, a simple Christmas song.
You have to remember, she was a child prodigy. She started writing when she was 7 years old.
This is Bob Griever, her grandson, in an interview with the San Antonio News right before he passed in 2016.
Wow, I'm fascinated by child prodigies. Was she a child star?
Well, not a child star in a published sense, but it just kind of goes to show how the family recognized that she had talent at a very young age. And because they were a wealthy family, they had the means to travel.
She went from Spain, and then she studied in France, and then she studied in Italy. They sent her all over.
Maria actually took classes with Claude Debussy.
Debussy? Like?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Like the Debussy. She went back and forth from Mexico to Spain until she was about 15. Her father passes away and they move back for good. This is right around the turn of the century. Flash forward to 1907, where Maria marries Leon Griever, a businessman who was the best man at her sister's wedding. They have 4 children, only 2 of which survive past childhood. She's writing in Mexico, music that would get published later.
Okay, so she's getting her name out there.
Right, so we're now in 1916. So this is where things start to get hazy. The widely published story is that Maria Griever and her children were sent by her husband to live in New York City due to political instability during the Mexican Revolution. She would have been probably around 31 years old.
And her husband, Leon, so he stays behind?
Yeah, for work. So in this book that I bought, it's called Maria Griever, Poeta y Compositora, and it's by Maria Luisa Rodriguez Lee. Charles Griever, Maria's son, details having fled amidst the revolution. But there's more to this, which I found out from the family. For now, we know Maria Griever is heading alone with her 2 kids to the Big Apple. Remember, Maria was a child prodigy, so she sang and she played several instruments. She was a soprano, so it's a person who sings at the top of the vocal range. But her future really was as a composer. I found a newspaper clipping of a recital as far back as 1919. It was a review of a performance at the Prince's Theater, and it states,
Her voice was not well controlled, and in a moment of greatest intensity, the tones were spread. Miss Greva needs more technique and less emotion.
Ooh, yikes. Not good.
Yeah. You know, she wasn't really singing her songs just yet, but it was kind of a way to get yourself out there and known. And what do people in New York City do when they want something?
Well, they hustle.
Exactly. You and I both know that. If you don't hustle in New York City, you don't go anywhere. And Maria Griever hustled.
In this book, there's articles where she's quoted as being a great conversationalist, and she knew how to make friends, and she obviously knew how to network. The Brooklyn Daily Eagle.
Maria Griever is one of the busiest women in all New York.
Which is interesting because it was a time that was pretty unforgiving to women who were kind of owning their voice, their power.
Exactly. Yeah. This is Dr. Leon Garcia Corona. He's a doctor in musicology and assistant professor at Northern Arizona University.
So when Maria Griever moved to the States, she was in the middle of the development of mass media. We have the radio, we have records, and we also have movies. You have to know people and you have to be within the network of people who are part of it.
And that network pays off when Maria Griever gets published by G. Shermer, a big publishing house, in 1926. It wasn't the first, but it was the first one to make big waves.
So this term published, I mean, that's not exactly how music works today. So what does that mean, publishing?
So sheet music was how you sold your music. Sheet music was the LP, CD, or MP3 of that time.
So that's like actually on paper, right? It's where you're seeing the notes, the charts, you use that to play music.
Exactly. So in order to get your music heard, you had to have your music published by a publishing house.
Right. So basically people buy the sheet music and then it's played at a recital or a concert or a party, because this was the decade where theater actually was king.
And one of the experts I spoke with about early New York City said that theaters were how people in those days were exposed to other cultures and saw what was relevant in pop culture. If you got a theater gig, you basically made it. It was like peak celebrity.
And Maria got into the theaters in New York City and was doing that kind of work?
Right. She's out there making things happen. The song she publishes is Jurame, which, Maria, I'm pretty sure you've heard. Little Luis Miguel, little Julio Iglesias.
Oh my God, I'm so right there. I mean, it's just like memories. And Jurame is basically saying, swear to me that you love me, swear to me that you won't leave. Very dramatic.
Super dramatic.
And so are you saying that the song was a major success, even though the song was performed always in Spanish?
Yeah, it was well received. Here's Dr. Garcia Corona again.
And it was received in beyond the constraints of language, because, I mean, she would compose something in Spanish. But again, the melody, the lyricism of the music transcended political boundaries and transcended also language barriers.
Maria Griever wrote tangos, waltzes, boleros, and all of that tried to keep as much of her roots as possible. And so although Maria Griever left Mexico, Mexico never left her, as cliche as that is. She was very adamant about being Mexican and showcasing her Mexican music and pride. From an interview printed in the Rodriguez Lee book, Maria is quoted as saying the following statement, read by one of our fellow producers, Victoria Estrada.
I am interested in your American jazz, and I'm interested in modern music, but I'm interested most of all in my own Mexican music, and I want to try and present it for the Americans. I do not think that they know very much about it, and it is worth knowing. There is a wealth of song culture in Mexico.
All right, so I'm following along, but, you know, from getting your sheet music published on paper to Jurame becoming a big hit, how does it happen?
So as the story goes, Jose Mojica, who became a very famous Mexican tenor, randomly picked up the sheet music at a music shop with his pianist and recorded Jurame in 1927. With the success of Jurame, she starts to get published even more.
And like we heard in the beginning, Maria writes Cuando Vuelva a Tu Lado, or What a Difference a Day Makes, in 1934. And she starts to get contracts from the big movie houses. She scores for Paramount, MGM, Fox.
This is the 1930s, the golden age of radio. And Maria Grever was everywhere. Aside from radio plays, she's also playing at Carnegie Hall. Here's the transcriptions of old radio programs and newspaper clippings in the late 30s and 40s.
A song from the pen of Latin America's favorite lyric composer, Maria Grever. One of the best-known composers living today, who was born and brought up in Mexico. Don Maria Grever, composer of the suddenly sensational hit, Tippy Tin.
The biggest blockbuster hit for her comes in 1938, and it's a song called Tippy Tin.
Here's a quote from an interview with Maria Grever in the Cincinnati Enquirer from April 1938.
Critically ill and in great pain, I had just received a sedative. The effect made me faint, and I remarked to the doctor, I feel tippy. The word tippy caught my fancy. Somehow it seemed to have a happy message. The piano was at my bedside. Within 3 minutes' time, I had composed a song.
That song spent 6 weeks at the number one spot in what was known as your hit parade.
So kind of like the Billboard Hot 100.
Right, exactly. The interesting thing here is that even though Maria had several hits to her name at that point, publishers didn't want to publish the song. From a newspaper interview documented in the Rodriguez Lee book, Maria Grever says,
I had such a strong faith in the song, but the publishers thought I was crazy. I had been 20 years before an audience, and as a sensitive artist, I feel the vibrations of the public. I knew the song would be a success, so I published it myself.
And then Portilla Music Publishing Company was born.
You know, sometimes when you say no to a Mexican woman, she'll just say, well, I'll do it on my own.
So Maria Grever is now a household name. She's translated lyrics for Cole Porter. She wrote music for a Broadway show in 1941 called Viva O'Brien. It didn't do well, but the music was praised. And in 1944, they used one of her songs as the main theme for a movie called Bathing Beauty, starring Esther Williams and Red Skelton. The movie was a commercial success. And the song isn't just like one of the songs from the movie. It's the main melody. It's the theme that's played over and over throughout.
Gee, it's fun to be people. Mm-hmm.
And you're going to recognize the song because... We're back to the lullaby.
Muñequita linda. Oh my God, she really did it all.
She really did. And think about who her competition was back then. Her contemporaries were Irving Berlin, Cole Porter, Gershwin, Lecuona from Cuba, Gardel from Argentina. She was one of the very few women or even men composers who wrote the music and lyrics. So in 1948, when she was in her early 60s, Maria Grever suffered a stroke, and that left her paralyzed on one side. She still managed to be a huge force. Here's Bob Grever, Maria's grandson, from the San Antonio News interview again.
I remember we were in Carnegie Hall, and she couldn't walk, so we were in the wheelchair. And when they finished, they started yelling in her, where's Maria Grever? We want to see Maria Grever. Bah, bah. That place is jammed. And she couldn't get up, but she forced herself up and turned and faced the audience.
It's a strong woman.
I love that. I love the story. I love her strength. So I guess what I'm not understanding is that Maria Grever was doing pretty big, like into the 1950s. So again, when does she kind of fade into the darkness?
Well, Maria, while I finally got some answers, I had so many more questions. What happened to her husband? Why did he send her to New York City? How did she make it work? Why don't we all know her name?
So we're going to find out more about Maria Grever's interesting life and what happened to her legacy. And we're going to find that all out when we return. Remember, no te vayas, stay with us.
Thank you.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo, modern management made simple. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, we're back. So when we left off, producer Ginny Montalvo had just given us the breakdown on Maria Griever's life. But Ginny, I get the timeline and I understand that she was successful, but I guess I'm really interested about the struggles and the challenges, the ones that her great-grandson, Lee Griever, mentioned when you were finally able to get someone from the family to speak with you.
Yes, Maria, I also wanted to know more. Because on paper, she was married, and all we see is success and how prolific she was at composing. But something was missing for me, and that was New York City as a destination.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that New York City has always been expensive, and it was expensive back then, too.
Yes, and as a woman with two kids, it didn't make any sense if, like, all you wanted to do was leave political turmoil. You know, we mentioned in part one that Maria Griever left amidst the Mexican Revolution.
Yeah, so it would be logical that you would move somewhere where you had family so you could have help because, you know, women didn't have a lot of rights back then in 1916. You know, white women just got the right to vote in 1920. Maria Griever, a Mexican immigrant, more than likely would not have even been able to work.
Bingo. So, if you want to make it in New York City, yes. But as a random choice to flee the revolution, New York City is a super tough place to target. And so I began to read between the lines.
Well, New York City was in many ways a cultural hub.
This is Dr. Leon Garcia Corona again, the doctor of musicology we heard from in part one.
If you wanted to make it in the music industry, you have to go to New York City because this is where you have the Tin Pan Alley, you have the publishers.
Tin Pan Alley was a street in the early 20th century that basically was a hub for music publishers. In those days, it was typical for businesses to kind of group together in certain areas. So if you wanted to get your music published, you'd try at one.
And then if it didn't work out, you'd just like walk down the street?
If you wanted to make it, you have to be there. You have to be talking to the publisher. You have to be talking to the producers. You have to be within the musicians. So everyone was there. Then companies like RCA Victor, Columbia Records, copywriting a lot of music.
New York City is definitely where her career blossomed and reached new heights, because as we've been seeing, New York is where everything was happening. And Maria further making my case was when I realized that Leon Griever, her husband, was not from New York. He was from Ohio. So as a mother myself, like you said, I would obviously go somewhere I knew someone and had help. Unless, of course, you had other motives.
That makes sense.
And Maria Griever navigated the city in a difficult period of U.S. history.
The world was going through a lot of very important transformations and a lot of vulnerability was in the air, either economic vulnerability or also political vulnerability.
What was happening in the world also gave me a glimpse of understanding how her music blew up.
Obviously, there was the Mexican Revolution, which was primarily a civil war, and of course, the U.S. got involved, as they often do. So there's a lot of tension between the U.S. and Mexico. You've got the stock market crash of 1929.
Right. The Great Depression. There was the massive deportation of Mexicans and Mexican Americans in the 1930s. Then the beginning of World War II.
Exactly. So women didn't just write music at the time. It wasn't a job you did, but Maria did it.
The music that Maria Grieber was composing spoke to that, feeling of vulnerability and the sentimentality kind of echo in the hearts of listeners. I think that's why her music was so well received, not only by music publishers, but by a larger audience.
Wow, that's so interesting. I mean, people can love music in Spanish, but they aren't always so welcoming to people around them speaking it. I mean, this is just kind of a fascinating contradiction that has existed in the United States for a long time.
Yeah, and it hasn't changed, really. People hate it, but people buy it. People don't like Mexicans, but they love Mexican restaurants. There's always been a lens and interest on the other, right? What's different, what seems exotic.
Yes, you can have an ideological position, but if there's somebody who will buy this album, then there's space for that.
So basically, Jeannie, I'm feeling like you're saying there was a market for what Maria Grieber was putting out.
Despite being a woman and an immigrant.
It was a time period where it wasn't what they were supposed to be doing, right? So you can imagine the conflict.
Maria, I'm super excited to introduce you to Stuart Livingston, Maria Grieber's other great-grandson, who Lee Grieber connected me with.
Wait, another great-grandson?
Yeah, so real quick. Maria Grieber's two kids were Charles Grieber and Carmen Livingston. Lee, who we heard from earlier, is on the Grieber side, and Stuart is obviously on the Livingston side. Okay, back to Stuart.
And then in my great-grandmother's case, you know, she had left Mexico. She had left her husband behind. She was a single mother in a time where that was certainly not who you were supposed to be. And she was pursuing a career, which was not the perceived right way for a woman to act.
Not the right way for a woman to act. And add to that, a Mexican woman.
Well, it's like we were discussing earlier. What were women doing in the early part of the 20th century? Certainly not what Maria Grieber was doing. I asked Stuart what it was like to grow up with such a musical legacy. And as tends to happen, we don't get into our grandparents until we're older. And by then, it's usually hard to get to know more. So he eventually started working with his uncle, Bob Grieber, which we've been talking about. And that was his main connection to learning more about her.
He knew her as his grandmother, but they lived in New Jersey and she lived in Manhattan. So as he says, she was sort of a mystery to him too. And it wasn't until he got into his father's music publishing business and started working in Mexico that he started to learn a great deal more about his grandmother. But even then, comparing stories that my father understood with stories that my tío understood, you know, there were either gaps or completely different stories.
And these gaps, Maria, are exactly what I was trying to figure out. There's probably so much more, but I was able to piece together from my investigations and speaking with the family.
She clearly stayed to herself, or she kept the music side of her life away from her family. She was such an accomplished composer that the movie studio sought her out. So there's sort of this whole, clearly a lot going on professionally with her, but she kept that separate from her family.
It's this generation of women who didn't really speak about career, and that silence gets perpetuated through the generations.
My father and my uncle always made a point of not talking about her personal life, okay? Which, when you look back on it, I think it speaks volumes.
I'm sure this is the story in so many families.
I mean, personally, my grandmother was kind of similar. Like, I found out a bunch of stuff after she passed about her career and all of the accomplishments she had made, but it was something that she absolutely never talked about.
So it becomes clear as to why the information that's out there is all the same. It's because there wasn't that much personal information to find.
But didn't Stewart say she was a single mother?
Good catch, Maria. One of my big questions was whatever happened to her husband, because it adds a layer to how we perceive her story.
Because you had said her husband had stayed behind in Mexico to work, and she's going alone to New York, and it wasn't clear whether or not they were ever reunited.
Because nothing ever says that they did. Everything says he stayed behind to work, or in the movie, it says that he had to go back to deal with the business falling apart. But it's never clear if they got back together.
That part is a real mystery. He never joined the family in New York. As I understand it now, that may be the clean version.
Oh, the clean version. Okay, so then there's a whole underground version that's becoming even more intriguing. All right.
Yeah, no one ever talks about reunion because apparently...
Let's just say that from the circumstances, it was fairly clear that there was a separation.
So you've got a woman in the 20s and 30s who has separated from her husband with two kids and later founded her own publishing company.
I mean, she really was just going to make things happen for herself, with or without a man. I mean, that's super forward thinking.
Super, yeah. And all of her documentation that is of public record says married, because I guess on paper in the 1930s, you didn't really get divorced. But I think it's a fascinating piece of the puzzle, because it means she actively chose New York for her career. And Stewart even told me that the family lore he heard growing up was that someone actually came to poach her from Mexico. This well-known group of entertainers came and convinced her to move to New York City, which was a thing back then.
I mean, that's a pretty big deal, right? Somebody comes and says, hey, we think you're an incredible songwriter. We want you to move to New York. Come on. I mean, I just think it's so adventurous.
It just changes the story completely. It's less about fleeing a revolution. It's more of like taking an active role in your destiny, I guess, if you want to say it that way.
I'm definitely seeing a more driven Maria Griever who's wanting to make it in New York. But I can also begin to see why the history books have it one way because of the time period.
Yeah, I mean, it's curious to me because in the biopic from 1954, it's super 1950s.
El marido por un lado, la mujer por otro. Mucho cantar volveré, pero ni uno va ni el otro regresa.
It made her character in the movie, like, not necessarily weak, but that things just kind of happened to her.
Si usted acepta, yo puedo dejarle mis canciones. Quizá encuentre alguna que le guste.
I really kind of imagine her as this go-getter rebel, like, hustling to make it in the city. A single mother with two kids working in an industry dominated by men. Here's Stewart Livingston again.
You had a lot of publishers who took advantage of that situation. So she oftentimes sold her music as opposed to keeping ownership and collecting royalties. It was due to her genius that she was able to make it work.
So, Maria, royalties are what songwriters and artists collect on music they've written based on how much it sells.
Right. And you always hear about these fights with the streaming services and how difficult it is for musicians to collect those royalties, which is what they can live off of.
And back then, you could sell sheet music and get royalties. Or sometimes if you were desperate, you would do a buyout and just sell the music. And that still happens today. But that obviously doesn't favor you if you wrote the next Despacito.
You know, she was prolific in producing her music. And as a result, that's how, you know, she succeeded and survived. But in those days, there just was no collection process that really worked. That was the issue, is that she actually was always struggling day to day, week to week, month to month to pay the bills.
And because she often sold the rights to her music.
We actually don't know how many songs she actually wrote. I've heard numbers that are as high as 1,000 and as low as 700, which would still be a phenomenal body of work. But in terms of music that was in her catalog that she was collecting royalties on, we only have roughly about 94, 95 pieces.
That's 1/7 or 1/10 of the work she produced.
That's so sad that so much of her music isn't linked to her name.
Just think about how much she had to be writing for a minute to have a catalog of, let's say, 1,000 songs, right? Here's a quote from a newspaper interview with Maria Griever from 1943 I found in the Rodriguez Lee book.
Hago mis canciones en tres o cuatro minutos. el tiempo que necesito para interpretarlas. Para mí es una necesidad escribir para expresar mis pensamientos.
Rodriguez Lee says it wasn't clear if this was always the case, but think about it. Like, if she could write a song in 3 or 4 minutes, how many songs could she write in a day or a week? What is also incredible is how she really never lost sight of her roots either. You know, we were talking earlier about her Mexicanidad and how she really tried to pull that into her music. She tells this story in another newspaper interview from 1936 from the Rodriguez Lee book. She was performing a concert at Carnegie Hall when someone yells out, "Viva México!"
La concurrencia quiso callar al paisano. Entonces, avancé al proscenio, ordené un instante de silencio a la orquesta y pronuncié estas palabras. Vamos a gritar todos de pie un Viva México, o de lo contrario no sigo el concierto.
She stopped the orchestra because people tried to shush them, and said, if we don't all shout Viva México, I'm not going to continue the concert.
Wow, that's incredible.
Here's Stewart again.
She was truly, truly proud to represent Mexico in terms of her music. And you can feel it in the melodies. And it showed in her son. Charlie Griever was always proud.
Charles creates Griever Music Publishing, or Griever International, which became a powerhouse and had a huge Mexican music catalog.
And then it showed in her grandson, Bob Griever.
Bob Griever was actually a huge deal. He owned a record label in San Antonio, Texas, called Kara Records. He was often called the Tejano music giant and was actually the first person to sign our very favorite, Selena.
Wow, this is like an incredibly musical family for him to sign Selena?
Yeah, the Selena at 12 years old.
They were very, very proud of their Mexican roots. And they built their business based on their Mexican roots.
So, Maria Griever, did she ever get any recognition while she was alive?
Right before she passed, Maria Griever received the Medal of Civil Merit and the Medal of the Heart of Mexico in 1949. And after she passed, her obituary was actually in the New York Times. And in Mexico, there's a scholarship named after her. Mexico also made the biopic that we've been talking about from 1954, Cuando Me Vaya. And it really kind of brings her back into light.
The film itself in Latin America was hugely successful. In fact, reintroduced her music to a whole new generation of Latinos. And it played all over South America and Central America and Mexico.
It starred Libertad Lamarque, the Mexican Argentine actress we mentioned earlier. She was hugely popular in the 50s. She also made an album to go along with it called Libertad Lamarque, Canta Canciones de María Griever, or Songs of María Griever, of which I bought the LP.
Of course you did.
Which became one of the most successful albums of that era. And that was one of the first big windfalls of royalties to Griever Publishing, was the success of that album.
It's very similar to what happens with a lot of artists now. You know, they don't basically reap the benefits of their work until they're very late in life or after they've died.
Even without the monetary success, she was unbelievably successful in terms of perception, in terms of how the Mexican community looked at her. She was a true icon.
In 1952, she was named Woman of the Americas by the Union of Women of the Americas. And the song we talked about in the beginning, What a Difference a Day Makes, by Dinah Washington in 1959, won the Grammy that year for Best Rhythm and Blues Performance. And that was Dinah Washington's first top 10 hit on the Billboard Hot 100. It was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 1998.
She was an extraordinary woman. She was a gifted composer. You know, you look at her life, and in spite of the hardships, she succeeded at everything she tried to do. And that's an amazing statement. And it's a particularly amazing statement for a woman who raised 2 children on her own during that time period. I'm incredibly proud of who she was as a composer. But what I'm also saying is I'm incredibly proud of who she was as a human being.
Muñequita linda, de cabellos de oro, de dientes de pelas, labios de...
So, Jeannie, after you've been through this pretty incredible journey, I'm wondering, what's your biggest takeaway about Maria Griever?
I think what's really been fascinating to me, Maria, is one, finding Maria Griever's family and getting to speak with them directly about her history and her legacy, but also being able to understand her more as a person. I feel like women musicians throughout history are not really that different from who we are today. They just didn't have as many rights as we do today. And when you hear these stories about these pioneers, they all have in common that they were hustlers. And I feel like that's a big part of why we're telling her story.
And so, Jeannie, we have decided to continue on this journey. Every month, for the next few months, we're going to look at the life of one woman musician and their influential work.
Right. So you're going to follow me with a couple other producers to highlight the stories of pioneers you may or may not know, but we thought it was important to tell their stories.
And my paisana, my tocaya, fellow Maria Mexicana, kicked us off in our series in a big way.
Maria Griever was never forgotten. There just wasn't anyone around to tell her story. And so it falls on us to keep people like her present. You know, there's a saying they say a lot in women's music industry circles. If you can see it, you can be it. So we need to see someone like Maria Griever in history. Someone with an accent. Someone who left home. Someone who was otherized.
It says a lot that as a woman, as a Mexican woman, you can break all of these barriers and be this huge success. So I'm really glad that you did this work, Jeannie, because I'll never think of the song, What a Difference a Day Makes, in the same way. Maria Griever is going to be very present in my mind, and I kind of love that.
And I hope that she stays present in everyone's mind for as many years to come.
This episode was produced by Jeannie Montalvo and edited by Mitra Bonshahi and Marta Martinez. It was mixed by Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Fact-checking for this episode by Monica Morales. The Latino USA team includes Andrea Lopez Cruzado, Daisy Contreras, Mike Sargent, Julieta Martinelli, Victoria Estrada, Reinaldo Leaños Jr., Alejandra Salazar, Patricia Zulbarán, and Julia Rocha, with help from Raúl Pérez. Our editorial director is Julio Ricardo Varela. Special thanks to María Luisa Rodríguez Lee, author of the book María Griever, Poeta y Compositora, Richard Blondet, The Griever and Livingston Families. Our associate engineers are Gabriela Baez and J.J. Carubin. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Our fellows are Elisa Baena, Monica Morales, and Andrew Viñales. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Remember, no te vayas. And I'll see you on the next episode. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by New York Women's Foundation. The New York Women's Foundation, funding women leaders that build solutions in their communities and celebrating 30 years of radical generosity. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Okay, here we go. All right, that was a weird laugh. What is that? That's from, like, my cousin Vinny. Okay, here we go.